101A. I'm Jen White in Washington. Earlier this month, U.S. Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin made the unusual move to order a military-wide stand-down so they could address a very specific problem.
We need your help. I'm talking, of course, about extremism and extremist ideology, views and conduct that run counter to everything that we believe in, and which can actually tear at the fabric of who we are as an institution.
A recent NPR analysis found that 20% of those charged in the Capitol riot were current or former service members, and sprinkled through the crowd that day were Marine Corps flags, tactical gear, and unit patches. But the military isn't alone. A retired New York police officer was just charged with assaulting a D.C. officer during the insurrection. At least 30 police officers also attended the rally on January 6th. So why is white supremacy and far-right extremism infiltrated the ranks? And how can the police and military tackle the problem? Well, first, let's talk about policing. Here to discuss, we have Houston's Chief of Police and President of the Major Cities Chiefs Association, Art Acevedo. Chief Acevedo, welcome.
Good morning, and thank you. It's great to be on, and it's important to keep this conversation going, and I appreciate you doing so.
Also with us today, Michael German. He's a fellow at the Brennan Center for Justice at NYU's School of Law. He's also a former FBI agent. Michael, welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me.
And we also have Vita Johnson, professor of law at Georgetown University with a focus on policing. Vita, we appreciate your time today.
Thanks so much for tackling this important topic, and thanks for having me on the show.
So, Chief Acevedo, a former Houston officer was recently charged in connection with the Capitol riot. What happened?
Well, he decided to go to a rally with the encouragement of the president of the United States, former President Trump, traveled to the rally with his spouse, is my recollection, and he ended up going to the Capitol, which he was urged to do by the president and other speakers during that rally, and he ended up infiltrating the Capitol, breaching the Capitol, going inside the Capitol building, and consequently he's lost his career, and he's lost, and he may lose his freedom now that he's been charged with federal charges. It's so disappointing, and it's such a betrayal of our oath of office but I think it speaks to this issue's real, and it goes beyond race, right? Transcends race. This was a Vietnamese American, which really makes you try to wonder what the heck was this man thinking, and all the other cops and military that were there.
Well, you're now doing an investigation within your ranks to try to find other officers with extremist ties. What does that investigation look like?
Well, first and foremost, we're having conversations with our own folks. You know, fortunately, policing still has a lot of work to do to get better and to stay better and to try to keep us focused. But we are actually looking at our social media of our folks. Actually, we were doing that before this, talking to our staff and our team about the importance of actually being true brother and sisters keepers and true to their oath of office and their duty to report individuals within our ranks that may have those type of, extremist views.
Well, where is the line that would get an officer fired? Because in the case you mentioned, the officer has been charged with a crime. He resigned on his own before facing a disciplinary hearing. But is the criminal charges the line? Is it being a member of a hate group? Is it using racial slurs? How are you making those distinctions?
Well, it's all the above. It's having a mindset or expressing an opinion that runs contrary to the collective view of the American people of what the heart and mindset of a police officer should be. Look, police officers and public servants have a First Amendment right, but they are limited. They're limited as you compare it to a general public, because that's the cost of being, and I won't say some people may call it a burden, but I would say it's the responsibility to make sure that you don't espouse views or opinions that run contrary to the greater good of the organization and that hurt public trust. During the summer, this past summer, you know, we're talking right now about right-wing militias and maybe hate groups and sovereign citizens and oath keepers and those groups. But let's remember, during the summer, during the George Floyd rallies and protests across the country, I can't remember the exact number, but I think we had 10 of our own members that posted some views on social media that were racist, And I can tell you one sergeant, we uncovered it on a Friday. One of our local artists here, rap artists, brought it to our attention. And by Monday, he was no longer a member of the department. So, you know, if you have those views and you express those views and it comes to our attention, they're not consistent with the expectations of this department, of this profession, or the community we serve, and you will not be a member of law enforcement.
Vita, how much of a problem are white supremacist ideologies and far-right extremism in policing? What do we know?
I think it's a significant problem. I mean, we can just look to what happened on January 6th to know the extent of this problem. And we, our very democracy, our public institutions were threatened that day. We know from polling that somewhere around 10% of Americans hold far-right views. There was a poll right after Charlottesville that found that 10% of Americans thought it was acceptable to hold neo-Nazi views. And just after the Capitol insurrection, a similar poll was taken, this time by Reuters, and it was 12% of Americans agreed with the rioters. And so, you know, if you extrapolate to that, those numbers to police, it may be even higher when you consider that white men are overrepresented on police departments. So this is a really significant problem that's going to take all of our attention.
Michael, give us a sense of whether this is a growing problem or is it just something that's gaining more attention right now?
I think it's something that's just gaining more attention right now. When I was an FBI agent in the 1990s going undercover into white supremacist groups, my superiors warned me and the other police officers that I was working on the task force with that there were members of law enforcement that were sympathetic to these movements and that we had to be careful to protect the case and to protect my survival as an undercover agent within these groups. So it's a problem that's been known for a long time, and there's a number of FBI reports that reflect these warnings that have since become public. So if it's significant enough for the FBI to warn its own agents about the problem, it certainly deserves a broader attention and a national strategy to address it.
So if we've known about it, and there have been reports warning about it, why has there been so little movement?
I think part of the reason is because whistleblowers are not appreciated in law enforcement and the laws aren't there to protect them and the procedures aren't there to protect them. So I think that's one thing that has to change. The officers who work together know who the problem officers are, right? The communities they police know who the problem officers are. And when civilians make complaints and when police officers make discrimination complaints or report the misconduct of their fellow officers, that needs to be taken seriously. That's the first place to start. Because, you know, I'm more concerned about the police officers who engage in racial misconduct than somebody who might in the privacy of their own home harbor malign thoughts. So, you know, I think it is important that we focus on the officers who are engaged in misconduct and recognize that it is a spectrum of activity and that we have to have mitigation strategies to where if somebody hasn't crossed the line to where they can be terminated, that's not the end of the story, that we have other strategies that we use to make sure the public is protected from those officers.
Chief Acevedo, I hear Michael there talking about what's a larger cultural issue, that other officers maybe don't feel empowered or feel protected to speak up when they know there are bad actors in their midst. What are you doing to ensure there's a culture in your department that makes it possible for people to speak up when they see issues?
I think that for us, we create safe spaces for people. And we do that in several ways. One, we make sure that they understand it's their duty to report these mindset, duty report comments or things of that nature. Two, we take the reports very seriously and we immediately launch investigations. And three, we hold people accountable for those mindsets and we make it real clear through our actions that people with hate in their heart, people that are racist, people that are want to be part of a militia, you have no business in law enforcement. And lastly, we protect our folks that come forward. And I'm glad to say that if you come and look at our internal affairs files, you're going to find that there's a lot of officers here in Houston PD that actually are reporting their fellow employees when they fall short. But I think a part of that, I think Professor Johnson talked about it, is that we're a minority-majority city, probably the most diverse city in the country, but the city is served by a minority-majority police department that is predominantly homegrown. And so I think when you have that and you're reflective of the community, you're going to be reflective of those community values. And I think that's a big part of what we need to do to have the right people in our ranks.
We'll hear more from you and our guests in just a moment.
Support for NPR and the following message come from BetterHelp, offering online counseling. BetterHelp therapist Hesu Jo knows that lockdown has been hard on us as humans.
We as people are hardwired to connect with others, which is why this whole time is so difficult. The connection that happens between people can be very powerful, and how healing it can be to have a healthy relationship with someone.
To get matched with a counselor within 48 hours and save 10%, go to betterhelp.com/1A.
He was one of the most consequential architects of the civil rights movement, but you may never have heard of him.
For our Black History Month special series, Bayard Rustin, who made nonviolence part of the fight for civil rights and organized the March on Washington.
Listen now to the Throughline podcast from NPR.
We're discussing far-right extremism and white supremacist ideologies in the police and the military. Vita, can you help us better understand the history of white supremacist ideologies in policing?
Sure. You know, unfortunately, there's a long history of violent white supremacy in police departments. Some of the first police departments in the United States were groups of white men who organized to police Black enslaved people. And so this is something that has been in existence in policing for quite some time. You know, the police allowed thousands of Black people to be lynched without any legal consequences for those murderers. And, you know, in recent times, we have, you know, just since the election of Barack Obama, we have so many instances of police belonging to white supremacist organizations. In 2014, members of a police department in Florida were outed as members of the KKK. In 2015, an Alabama officer was identified as being a member of the League of the South. In 2017, an Oklahoma police chief was discovered to be a very influential white supremacist. In 2019, a prospective home buyer toured a Michigan officer's home and saw a framed KKK application there. But in addition to the officers who identify with these hate groups, there are officers who hold explicitly racist views without any hate group affiliation. And those are the ones that I worry about as well. We just know just over this past summer, officers in Wilmington, North Carolina were caught on their own body cameras dreaming of a race war and hoping to wipe Black people off the map. We know a San Jose police officer posted on a Facebook group, "I want to turn or let's repurpose hijabs into nooses." And there are scandals all across this country, even in cities like San Francisco and Miami, very, you know, diverse communities. So this is a nationwide problem and one that needs to be addressed.
Charles from Atlanta emailed, "It's one thing for police to root out white supremacists in their ranks after incidents such as the Capitol riot on January 6th. What are police doing to prevent such people from joining the force in the first place?" And Rodney emailed, "It takes 6 to 12 months before a person is hired to law enforcement, and even longer for agencies like the FBI. Are they thoroughly vetted? How is the department not able to determine the psychology or sociology of a recruit? Further, isn't there continuing training and education that addresses racism?" Chief Acevedo, I'll come to you on this, because as both of these listeners said, it's one thing to try to root out the problem once it's within the institution, but what about preventing it from taking root in the first place?
Well, I think those are really good points. And I can tell you that as part of our background investigation processes, we do a robust search of social media posts. We actually examine tattoos that officers or applicants We have those tattoos that are reviewed to see if they indicate affiliation with any type of hate group or gang affiliation or anything of that sort. But at the end of the day, I think the most important asset that we have and partners that we have is the community itself. People need to come forward when we go do the background checks, knocking on neighbors' doors, talking to coworkers, talking to supervisors. And when they know something, it's kind of like the know something, see something in terms of Homeland Security. We need to do that in terms of the security of our law enforcement forces. And we need to crowdsource. We need the community to come forward.
I'm curious because that bumps up against what I hear from a lot of people who point to a lack of trust between communities and police departments, and trusting that they will be safe if they share that kind of information, trusting that they won't be targeted in other ways if they share that kind of information. It seems like you have more than one bridge, more than one gap to bridge if you're asking the community to interact in that way.
Well, I mean, everything starts with trust, right? That's why we tell our men and women on day one when they come to the academy, as I walk in there and I tell them the court of public opinion matters to everything we do. And our job is to build relationships that build trust. And so you got to continue to work at that. And so part of the problem is that people don't want to complain. They don't want to share information because they don't trust us. But the one thing that I do know that we don't come forward, the bad person will get on because of that missing piece of information. We won't have it. We'll have to hire them if we can't find it. So one of the things that we haven't done in the past that I've shared with my colleagues is when we do the polygraph examinations that just about every department administers, we ask them about criminal offenses. We ask them about drug usage. But you know what I just found out? We weren't asking about hate or racism to see how they react to those questions. And so I can tell you, if we weren't doing it in this department, there's a good chance a lot of departments weren't doing it. So we're adding that piece of it to our polygraph exam.
I want to bring you in here, Vita, because we got this email from Logan who says, are police officer candidates psychologically evaluated before they become officers? Would this help with the issue of extremism? And you heard from Chief Acevedo there describing some of the measures they're taking. What else do you think would be effective?
Well, I think the good news is this is now something that we're talking about and thinking about. But I think there's a lot of different things that we could think about to root this kind of thing out. But the biggest thing is not to hire a white supremacist in the first place. And I think the background checks are so essential. There's a kind of harrowing story about a police officer in Little Rock, Arkansas, who was honest and said he had attended a Klan rally as a teenager. And that department hired him anyway. And he went on, unfortunately, to kill an unarmed Black teen. And so this is something that needs to be looked at. And I think we need to talk about increasing diversity on police forces. So not only are white people overrepresented on police forces, but men are overrepresented on police forces. And we know that gender diversity is important to make people safer. We know that women are more likely to de-escalate a tense situation, less likely to belong to extremist groups, and less likely to use deadly force. So that's something we need to be looking at in hiring. And we need to continue monitoring people once they're hired. So, you know, the political views that you may have at 22 when you're hired aren't the same ones you're going to have at 37, right? And we know that people become more political as they age. So there are so many different things that we need to do to root out this problem.
We'll continue our conversation on far-right extremism and white supremacist ideologies in law enforcement in just a moment.
Support for NPR and the following message come from BetterHelp, offering online counseling. BetterHelp therapist Hesu Jo knows that lockdown has been hard on us as humans.
We as people are hardwired to connect with others, which is why this whole time is so difficult. The connection that happens between people can be very powerful, and how healing it can be to have a healthy relationship with someone.
To get matched with a counselor within 48 hours and save 10%, go to betterhelp.com/1A.
He was one of the most consequential architects of the civil rights movement, but you may never have heard of him.
For our Black History Month special series, Bayard Rustin, who made nonviolence part of the fight for civil rights and organized the March on Washington,
Listen now to the Throughline podcast from NPR.
Let's get back to our conversation on far-right extremism and white supremacist ideologies in law enforcement. Michael, to your mind, what's the best way to identify and root out extremists in policing? And I want to point to this email we got from Rich, who says, I'm a retired federal law enforcement officer. I reported a supervisor for racist behavior in 2004. The supervisor was transferred and ultimately retired. Meanwhile, my career was stagnated. I was told I would never get promoted as a result of my reporting, and I did not. Your thoughts?
Not surprised. And, you know, that's really the a big part of the problem is that the people who report are more in danger than the people who engage in racial misconduct. So and there's a second aspect to this. Part of the problem is that a significant amount of the police training trains this kind of behavior. Right. We saw the blatantly Islamophobic counterterrorism training that law enforcement has been flooded with since 9/11. And, you know, add that to the nativism that comes out in a lot of the border issues. And, you know, particularly when we had a president who cultivated that kind of racial thinking and then cultivated a vision of a very violent police activity that that culture combined to where it's putting these white supremacists and far right militant groups into the same space where law enforcement was. So I don't think anybody should have been surprised to see that there were police officers at not just at the rally but participating in the riot.
Chief, how much time do you spend trying to assess someone's psychological state? Because it's one thing to look at someone's social media, but maybe they're not on Facebook, maybe they're not on Twitter, maybe they don't have tattoos. How deeply do you delve into what is going on in a potential officer's head?
You know, what's happened, and Professor Johnson mentioned this, is, you know, we have to do the psychology test, but here's the problem. People change, right? People's mindsets change. And one of the things we're working on right now in Texas is trying to get legislation so we can do psychological examinations on a regular basis, like every 3 years, you know, come up with some kind of cycle and an update on somebody's background to see what's been going on. But that's an uphill battle because obviously labor is fighting it. It's members of our legislature have introduced it again. I support it. And I support it because I think if we did that, we can do it, but only for a fitness for duty. It's too late. That means that it's already manifested itself in behavior. I think we'll save careers, marriages, and lives if we were to do that on a regular basis. And that's something we're working on now because we're not doing it often enough as a profession.
Vita, what role do police unions play in this conversation?
Well, unfortunately, they make it very difficult for officers to be fired. And that is one of the biggest battles we have in rooting these sorts of officers out. When an officer violates policy or violates the law, it's really important that that officer is dealt with swiftly. If he's not, that undermines not only the community trust, but morale on the force. And it sends a message to younger police officers that that behavior is acceptable. But labor unions for police have created it circumstances where police enjoy more protection than almost any other profession. And so it's you know, absolutely wrong. It should be the other way around, that people who are given tremendous amount of discretion over a person's life and liberty, given weapons, given access to, you know, sensitive information, if they cross lines, they should be terminated very quickly.
But then there's also this issue of officers leaving one force and joining another. And I'm curious how we address that issue. And Vita, I'd love to hear from you, and then Chief, from you as well on this.
Well, one thing that I've been thinking a lot about is the idea of a national federal licensing program that would set some sort of minimal guidelines, do some additional background checks for police departments that maybe can't afford to do thorough ones. And if an officer crosses a line, he loses his license. And then he can't get rehired by any force that would require that license. And so that's one of the things that I'm proposing to stop this problem.
Chief, what about you?
You know, what's interesting is that people don't know that in the state of Texas, even if you got a dishonorable discharge, and your separation paperwork on your license says dishonorable, you don't lose your license. You have to have two dishonorable discharges in order to lose your licenses. Why is it if you're dishonorably discharged from the Marine Corps, you can't go enlist in the Army? That we've got to change that, I think, immediately. And a national database on this issue, as well as a national minimum standards, because we have the worst policing model in the nation, in the free world. 18,000 police departments with 800,000 cops. And believe me, the vast majority don't have the training and the procedures that the big cities do. And so we want to have good policing. We have to invest in a system where we consolidate agencies and we can have more synergy and I think more consistency across the nation.
Michael, when you worked at the FBI, you infiltrated white supremacist and right-wing militant groups, and you wrote recently about how the FBI has been warning about this connection between police and the far right for a while now. What exactly has the FBI known, and how much of that has been shared with police departments?
Very little. It was fascinating to me to see in black and white an FBI warning to its agents telling them to alter their processes in counterterrorism cases when they investigate white supremacists, because there's a chance that, or not even a chance, they say they often have links to law enforcement, and then nothing else in that policy talks about what the agents are supposed to do about the white supremacist officers. And, I just want to say I appreciate the way Chief Acevedo has spoken out publicly about this issue, and I think that'll help. And one of the things that it is an idea that Professor Johnson originated is to get prosecutors involved, because if these officers who engage in racist misconduct are put on Brady lists or no-call lists, their ability, even if they're still on the job, to actually go out on the streets and police is much reduced. And I saw that in the FBI when the Supreme Court Giglio decision came down, and any agent who had a previous disciplinary issue that involved a false statement was all of a sudden not able to go on the street because they couldn't testify in a courtroom. So I think that's a very effective model, and also puts it in the hand of prosecutors rather than the police chiefs alone and having to bear the responsibility for this problem.
Vita, we got this email from Molly who says the official strategy of these extremist groups is to infiltrate colleges, police departments, and to run for office. This is proven. How much do we know about strategy?
Well, I'm afraid I'm not an expert on that. I know that policing isn't a great profession for someone with those views, because they get to subjugate people of color. But, what their other strategies are, I'm probably not the best person to answer that question.
Michael, can you chime in on that?
Sure. But these groups do have strategies and do encourage members to join police departments in the military so they can get that kind of training. But a lot of times it's not necessary. I mean, we just have to understand that white supremacy is part of our culture. So the people that are being recruited into law enforcement and the military are being recruited out of that population where this is persistent.
Michael German, fellow at the Brennan Center for Justice at NYU's School of Law. Also with us today was Houston's Chief of Police and President of the Major Cities Chiefs Association, Art Acevedo, and Vita Johnson, a professor of law focusing on policing at Georgetown University. Vita, Chief Acevedo, thanks so much for joining us today. Today's producer was Michelle Harvin. Our podcast is produced by Barb Anguiano. This program comes to you from WAMU, part of American University in Washington, distributed by NPR. I'm Jen White. Thanks for listening, and let's talk more soon. This is 1A.